If you've been dreaming of a new home, but you're not sure how to begin the process of buying one, you should check out our friends over at Leaders Credit Union, because whether you're a first-time home buyer or you're looking to move to a new house, the mortgage champions at Leaders Credit Union are here to guide you from the application process all the way to closing. They have a fantastic app for you to use. You can even get pre-qualified right there on the app. So when you go around looking at homes, you can go ahead and make an offer because you're pre-qualified with your letter. Visit leaderscu.com/ESPN to check out the latest opportunities and see how Leaders can be a financial champion for you. Also want to remind you that Leaders Credit Union, of course, is a credit union working for the benefit of their members, over 84,000 members strong, and they've been awarded in the top 10% of healthiest credit unions nationwide by depositaccounts.com, and they're also listed in the top 100 credit unions by S&P Global. They've created that webpage just for our listeners, leaderscu.com/ESPN, so that they can help you learn how they can champion your financial story and even waive your membership fee. 85,000 fee-free ATMs, and also check out their mobile app that makes banking from your phone simple, easy, and available 24/7. LeaderCU.com/ESPN. Let's get into the list. Masai Ujiri. Yes, this according to Tim McMahon and Sham Sharania of ESPN. The Dallas Mavericks have agreed to hire Masai Ujiri as their team president and alternate governor, landing a lead basketball executive with a proven champion experience. And after a six-month search process, the team settled on him on Monday. Of course, Ujiri was the architect of the Raptors' 18-19 championship team, and that was the highlight of his 15-year tenure as the lead executive in the NBA. Also won the executive of the year back with the Denver Nuggets. So, Cobb, my first thought was, damn, this is feels like a good hire.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's going to be the easiest job ever to replace Nico Harrison. I mean, come on. Like, that's, I think, got to be among the all-time biggest failures of a general manager in any professional sport ever. So it almost feels like whoever they hired, okay, now they've got a guy who was the architect of a really impressive title run in the past decade. Like, aside from Nico's failure and that, what I would call the ease of following in those footsteps, it's like, all right, well, this guy's actually proven. He's really good. And I mean, it feels like a slam dunk. And he's actually, to be honest, I think he's got a pretty good canvas to work with here.
Well, I was going to say, the other reason why I think it's a great situation to walk into is, all right, you're walking into Cooper Flag and you're going to have another at least lottery pick this year. They actually have some cap flexibility. Like, they can actually do some things. But this is kind of what I've been wondering as, you know, we were talking about last segment with CJ. Is there like a formula right now? Because I actually think what makes the NBA more interesting in terms of building a roster right now than in years past is, it doesn't seem as simple as, all right, figure out a way to get three, I don't know, top 25 players. I mean, where do you draw the line? And then, you know, who cares filling out the rest of the roster? It's like, no, you have to have depth. You obviously have to have a lead stud, but I don't know if you have to have like three of them. Like, if we go back, who do you think is, so Jalen Williams, I guess, would say was the second best player last year, right, on the Thunder?
Yeah.
I guess the Celtics make it easy, whether or not you want to be a Tatum hater or not. It's like they have Tatum and Brown.
Right. Well, I think I you could argue like in their title run, Kristaps Porzingis was
a massive
part of that.
But then like with the Nuggets, so then you would either say, well, it's either Murray or Porter was pretty good that playoffs. I mean, Porter was good enough that they gave him the contract that everyone was like, that contract's a disaster. But the reason they gave him that was because of what he did in the playoffs. But it doesn't, like, we're not exactly talking about, like, all right, you have to go and put three of the 15 to 20 best players in the NBA. But now it does feel like, okay, well, we need depth, but now there's this weird thing of like, are we just transitioning to like, you just got to be able to stop everybody? Like, we're not talking about prolific offenses anymore.
I think there's been a shift on a certain level, but I think it's also because a lot of the high caliber elite offensive weapons of the 21st century are starting to age out. Think about it. I mean, LeBron's north of 40. Steph is in the twilight of his career. Kevin Durant is nearing 40. James Harden has been out of his prime now for quite some time. I mean, these were the players who transformed the NBA. They became the bridges. I mean, on a certain level, like, you had the, what I would call like the heart of like the LeBron James era, you know, like the first, 13 years of his career, where he was like the preeminent force in the NBA. But then you also had this really nice complementary group of offensive oriented stars. But this next generation of the NBA, like when you look at Victor Wembanyama, and like, okay, sure, you want to talk about Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Yeah, I think he's more savvy. I think it's more about savvy. Like, you look at Luka. Like, is he just beautiful to watch? No, neither is SGA. I mean, they're not beautiful offensive.
No, I totally agree with both of you.
And so it's like, I think we've just moved into this new era where the superstars are not these beautiful, free-flowing offensive machines like Kevin Durant, like Stephen Curry, like LeBron in his prime. And you know, like, you could say James Harden was more in the SGA mold because he was always a little bit of a free throw merchant who played booty ball, right? But like, he never won a title. You know, so I think we're in an era now where the aesthetics are less important than it is like the two-way ability. And, you know, that's embodied with Wimby, who I think is the most impactful. He will go down as the most impactful defensive player ever to play the game of basketball.
And maybe we're looking at the wrong signals or the wrong, you know, you're asking the right questions, but you're looking in the wrong places. Like, what if the reality is we've spread out the talent so much, and we've done so either by the CBA with how much you can pay certain guys and like the mechanisms for keeping everyone, that they can't just all cluster. And what if what we're really watching is, hey man, the playoffs are kind of more, they actually resemble more of the NFL playoffs than they do probably previous NBA iterations, which is, it is just a war of attrition. And usually the team that's left standing at the end was the team that had the fewest injured players.
I hate that that's where we're at, but that does, I fear there is some truth to that.
Like, it does feel like a lot of the playoffs, you know, ever since we've gotten post-pandemic, like, they've been defined by injuries.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true of this year's playoffs. I mean, you look at Boston. I mean, honestly, if they had won a playoff series, that would have been unbelievably impressive to do that without Jason Tatum, right? Like, that would have been, when you look at the caliber of their 3-8, the fact that they were even in that series as long as they were, I mean, I think that's a really good coaching job. But yeah, it's an injury to a star player that's keeping them from competing at the highest level. And that is kind of the inverse of like what you see in Philly, where it's like, oh, well, if this is the Joel Embiid that we're going to get, then hold on here. Like, we might have a situation brewing, you know?
Well, and then it's also like, well, you know, he also in the third and fourth quarter, he was clearly banged up. And it's like, if that shows up again, to your point when we started the show, like, have we changed the narrative? Or are we just going to go right back to it? See, man, can't count on him when you need him. He's just hurt again. Yeah, it's like, I don't know, man. I know what I watched for four straight games, and it's like, the Celtics kind of like tipped their hand. It's like, yeah, the series changed when he got on the floor. Like, we didn't really have an answer. It's
like, well, and then it's going back to the Western Conference semifinals.
Well, let's go with the Embiid thing. And maybe this is the lesson. Can you just, like, and this is how we can localize it with the Grizzlies. Like, you simply cannot afford to give a big contract to somebody you cannot count on to play.
Yeah. But I also say, like, this idea of it's attrition and it's being healthy for the playoffs, you see how playing into that can do irreparable harm too. Because a year ago, and goodness, we've excoriated them for it a lot already, but the Grizzlies going over the top with load management last November and December, losing to the Nets, losing games they had no business losing because they assumed they would be at worst like the sixth seed or something. Well, then lo and behold, they mess around for too long. It doesn't work because guys are still getting injured.
Stretch of basketball at the wrong time. That stretch post All-Star break where they were just in a just god-awful funk.
I think you just got to try and win and let the chips fall where they may. And do your homework on guys too. I mean, injuries can happen to anybody at any time, but my gosh, like, and I let him off the hook with Zach Edey. Like, yes, like everything about the 7'4" guy trying to play 80 plus games screams like, whoa, hold on here. But there was nothing in his college basketball history to suggest he was going to be incredibly injury prone. I mean, he played pretty much every game for 4 years without any significant injury issues, which no, is,
I'm with you, I but mean, I also wonder, so that is all true. But I do wonder, like with Zion, remember coming out of Duke, guy never really had injury problems. And this was always my whole thing of like when people were trying to nitpick Zion, if your argument against Zion was you didn't think his game translated, well, then I was like, I don't really want to keep conversing with you because I don't think that's it. But if your argument was, hey, man, at this size, playing with this force, it's going to be a problem on his joints. Doesn't mean he's always going to be injured. But, hey, man, there's a lot of health concerns here. Well, it's like, well, that's a conversation I'm willing to entertain. And I'm not saying that existed with Edey, but, like, we also don't have the information.
Yeah, I don't think there were any legitimate red flags with Zach Edey, aside from the common sense factor that 7'4" bodies are not meant, especially at the pace at which the NBA is played now. You know, I think that's probably the biggest difference.
But what if that was the question? Because Edey, I mean, you know, the first people that pointed out, and again, maybe it's coincidental and you're just getting lucky, but, you know, we first saw him get hurt in summer league, and you're one of the ones that was talking about. It's like, man, he hadn't played at this pace before.
Yeah, it's different, and that's the biggest difference between the NBA now and 30 years ago is the pace of play. Now, I mean, it's the same 24-second shot clock, but you know, you look at the average number of possessions per game now between, let's say, 1995, huge difference. I mean, there's a significantly increased number of trips up and down the floor. And so, you know, it's almost like if you're going to put your eggs in the basket of the 7'4" guy, you kind of have to tailor your style of play. And that's what Purdue did so magnificently, was they oriented everything they did around Zach Edey and around getting him that touch on the left block so he could go over his left shoulder with the right hook with under 10 seconds left in the shot clock. Or if they were able to get him to seal the guy off in the first 10 seconds and go that route. Right. But like by and large, they played at a really slow pace offensively when he was on their team. And like, I just can't imagine, unless we continue to see a massive stylistic shift, like a ton of NBA franchises being willing to slow things down. I mean, the number of players who are worth that, it's like Joel Embiid and Nikola Jokic. Like that's the list. The guys who you tailor your pace and your system around in terms of,
well,
you know,
like historically, LeBron never played at the breakneck pace.
Well, that's true, but he's also built different.
100%. Like, and by the way, how many of him are there?
Yeah, one.
Like, but I've also wondered this. Maybe it's noise, but I was thinking about it with the Boston of it all. I get it. Three is still more than two. But look at how defenses are playing. now that basically everybody has adopted some form of the 3-2 shell, which let's just call it what it is. They're guarding the three and they're guarding the rim. Man, there's a lot of 15 footers that are wide open. And
that excites me. Like the I think we're in the early stages of a stylistic shift, you know?
Well, it's like almost going to be who's going to have the cojones to sit there and go, listen, we understand three is more than two, but a three with two hands in your face versus a two with zero hands in your face, like the math starts to balance back out.
We're already seeing that in college basketball, like with Michigan.
Well, that's why
Florida.
I keep wondering, like, in football, more times than not, the sport innovates bottom up. Like, usually what you will see is the people that are trying the most innovative stuff are usually in high school. Okay, well, then what happened is all these great players were playing in these systems that a lot of colleges didn't adopt. But now they had the pressure of, we got to get these guys on the field. So we start tailoring our offense to look like that. And then it's happened to the same thing with the NFL where it's like, all right, well, we got these high draft picks. We got to figure out how to get them on the field. Like, we'll adopt. Like, the difference between Sunday football and Friday night football has never been less. It still looks different from the guys that are playing it. But, like,
schematically,
it's more close. It's closer than ever. But that really hasn't been the case in the NBA. It's like, man, the NBA looks like a different sport from college, which looks like a different sport from high school. But like maybe like we're starting to see where all the elite level college teams are like, hey, man, we know threes are more efficient than twos, but when we got a bunch of 7-4 guys, like those twos are pretty efficient.
Yeah, and now especially over the course of a 7-game playoff series, like, The smaller the sample size, like the more important that diversity is. Because, like, yeah, I mean, you can look at the Celtics and, you know, will that be the norm or was that just the one time where it worked and then the rest of the league adjusted? But my point is, like, over the course of the 7-game series, when the shots aren't falling, like, you got to have that ability to go out and get the look, make the look where the look is presented, you know, and, the teams that are able to do that over these next few weeks are the teams that are going to be able to survive in advance. Now, I will say this. The free throw is like the great equalizer. Like, if you can get to the line on a regular basis, and I think that's what makes Shai Gilgeous-Alexander
that's
so unique.
You know, that's the whole Billis take. What's the most efficient shot in basketball?
Free throw.
You know, everybody wants to go layup, dunk, three. No, it's actually the free throw line.
If you're a 75% free throw shooter, that's 1.5 points per possession. You know, I mean, it's pretty good. You'd have to shoot 50% from three to equal that.
I just wonder if we're going to start to see, like, are some teams going to try some different approaches? And now normally that happens when you're in an era of, all right, we've got to figure out a way to catch up. Like, so for instance, if you're in an era of LeBron James and you're trying to figure out a way to beat LeBron plus probably two other top 25 players, if not better, that's a pretty limited field. Like, you're really, the only way of doing it is, all right, you got to go find basically three of those guys and pray to God. Well, now the teams that we're seeing that are everyone's oftentimes chasing, it's like, well, they don't have the cluster of high-end talent. Maybe they have one of those guys, or maybe they have one and a half, but everyone's focused on depth and whatnot. It's like, that's when maybe you can start to see some more interesting approaches of how can we actually, like, beat them. Because, like, that's the other thing. It's, if we're talking about if the Thunder are still the standard, what's the answer to them?
Well, and then it's, you think 5-6 years down the line, how are we going to score against Victor Wembanyama? Like, I think that's the
biggest
question.
Well, I was going to say, what if the answer is, well, yeah, you just get Victor Wembanyama. It's like, all right, is there another answer? Because, like, he might be one of one.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. And it's like, you're going to have to go through him to win NBA titles for the next 15 years, right? So what's the answer there? I don't know. The dude can block every shot on the floor. There's nothing. There's nowhere that his wingspan can, and lateral quickness combination cannot reach. So that's quite a perplexing question.
Because one of the group chats I was in was kind of debating this. For all the NBA takes, and let's be real, the NBA invites takes, is really the biggest problem we have with the product right now is there's not really a heel. There's no one to like really come together and be like, F this team, because the closest thing we have is the Thunder, and they're just not really there yet. Like, there's, like, we're really kind of reaching with foul baiting because we're at the point where acting like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is the only human being in the National Basketball Association that hunts fouls. It's like,
right.
Okay, well, if you got eyeballs and you watch more than one team, you know that's not true. And then the other problem is, all right, maybe the best answer to him is like the closest thing we've seen to an alien in professional sports. Like, do we just need to get back to the good old days of like, we just got to have some teams to hate?
Yeah. Well, maybe it's unique to Memphis, but Golden State does still check that box for me.
But they're not a threat anymore. You know what I mean? Like, it's the Empire after the Death Star has been blown up again.
I would say the Thunder could get there. If the Thunder roll to this NBA title, like, I think they'll get there. And in the process, it'll show us the blueprint of what I was talking about. Like, how do you manage against Victor Wembanyama, like in a competitive playoff series? And I guess the answer to that will be you get to the line a lot and you play really good defense and make timely shots, right? But like, I hope we get that series because I think that'll go a long way. Like that, if that's our Western Conference Finals, and I would venture to guess it will be, like that series will go a long way toward establishing the narratives for like this next era.
Oh, that's a good point.
The post-LeBron era.
That's a good take. I like that. The Western Conference Finals could like really set the table for the rest of the decade. Like how are we going to talk about this league? Hashtag this league. I kind of like that. Speaking of banana ball. All right. So on Saturday night, Auburn was playing Texas A&M in college baseball. And it was like on the college mix channel on DirecTV. So my wife just texted me. My wife points out, she's like, that's like a big baseball game and nobody's there. Like, what's going on? I had no idea, but later that night, after the 76ers, because I think on Saturday night, right, we went straight from Derby into Game 7, Sixers-Celtics, and then also concurrently, it was Flyers-Hurricanes Game 1. But after those games ended, there was kind of nothing. Like, we were in the void. And over, I don't remember if it was on ESPN or ESPN2, I'm looking up and I go, what the hell is that? Like, obviously, you recognize it's the yellow jerseys, it's the TikTok dances. That's the Savannah Bananas. But you're like, what stadium is that? And then they finally zoom out. They have sold out 102,000 tickets at Kyle Field for Banana Ball. And I keep waiting and I keep thinking, this thing is a fad and it has an expiration date. But what if I'm just wrong? Because this thing does not have any signs of slowing down.
Okay, so historical question. What was the life cycle of the Globetrotters? You know, I mean, that's the only comp. Where did they go
from? But that's such a different... Because, like, that is baked in history. It's like, all right, that's from an era in which the best black players weren't allowed to play. Like, there's a historical... This is literally just like, hey, man, like, we're starting this... Like, this is closer to me to, like, YouTube golf in terms of the disruption angle rather than the Globetrotters.
I mean, it's closer to me to, like, a Broadway show than it is to, like, an actual sporting event, you know?
I think you're right. The problem, though, that I keep seeing is like, A, number one, there's 102,000 people there. Like, how many got free tickets? Like, there's a business angle of just like, oh my God, like, even if 80% were legitimate tickets, and like, I know it's not the world's most expensive ticket out there, but it's not like, all right, everybody's paying, like, these aren't Sonic Savers getting in.
Shout out the old Sonic Savers.
I mean, you know what I mean? Like, because even when they came, I think we got the Indianapolis team, and then I think actually the Texas team that they were playing on Saturday night, the Bananas were playing. Like, we didn't get the Bananas, but I mean, like, that thing sold out in like 6 seconds.
Oh, it's insane. Like, if you just pull up a third party ticket website right now, like, you, like, the get in price at these games is like minimum $100. How much are these players making? How long until we get an actual, like, Major League Baseball player who's like, well, sorry, the money was better, I'm going to the Bananas.
Well,
Bananas.
So I was thinking about, it's like, okay, let's play it out. I think right now, a lot of the selling point is, hey, man, this is a place to build your brand. You're going to get eyes on you. You're going to build your brand. And they're kind of adopting, like, the influencer approach where, like, you'll make your money that way. They're obviously not paying them nothing. But it does seem to me like if you're trying to play this out and be like, what could really hurt this league? It's going to be the first players union, right? It's going to be the first players union, and they're going to go up against, what's that guy's name? Is it Jimmy? Who's the founder of Banana Ball?
Jesse.
They're going to go up against him. Like, that's right. Like, labor dispute's going to be what ends up bringing it down.
Yeah, you could just, you can go out and find Savannah Banana replacements a little easier than you can major leaguers.
Okay, but what if it gets to the point where everyone's like, I want to see Stiltzman or whatever?
There's no way, right? Like, are kids like that into it? Like, I think you just go right for the show. You're not like, oh, this is my favorite banana.
So I've been taking a more critical eye, trying to see, like, what is it about this? There's certainly an element of you go to be seen. It is like a, you go to the party. But the other thing that, and Cerrito tipped me off to this, because he said he took his daughter and he went with the, what is actually going on here? Like, that was his whole idea. They have like one of the, there's always like the big musical number. And if you watch it after that number, everyone files out. So clearly there's something about you have to get that video of you in the stadium at that time with, like, with those people.
It sounds like you've found something to study for, like, a doctoral dissertation. I like that you're really taking the analytical
approach.
It
blows my mind. Like,
so they're coming to Neyland later this month. And yeah, it's like, that's a 100,000 seat SEC stadium, and the cheapest ticket is well over $100.
Like, it blows me away in terms of, like, to your points, like, are kids going to grow up thinking, like, I don't want to play in the majors. Like, I just want to be the shortstop for the Bananas.
I could see that.
I think there are more kids that grow up saying, like, I'd rather be Bryson than, like, Cam Young, right?
Come on, we got to be competitors, man. I'll say this.
Like, I agree. I think it's a bad mindset, but I'm not saying.
I went and took ground balls with my nephew on Saturday.
Did you get hurt?
I'm still sore.
I was going to say, if you haven't done that one in a while, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Who knew that like, basically being at shortstop for 2 minutes taking fungos could get your heart rate up to 140 beats per minute. That's insane.
Yeah. It's not,
But my point is that he has a Bananas glove, right? Yeah. Like, he plays real baseball. He's a shortstop on his coach pitch team, but, like, he's got that Savannah Bananas glove, you know?
So sad. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, Chris Harrington joins us next. Stick around and listen to Jeff Wright and Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. Chris Harrington writes about the Memphis Grizzlies and more for the Daily Memphian. He's also the co-host of the Grizzlies podcast for the Daily Memphian with Drew Hill. He joins us each and every Monday on the program. Chris, what are we listening to?
It's Motown Philly by Boyz II Men. A little double shout out to the Detroit Pistons and Philadelphia 76ers. Both came back from 3-1 deficits to win their first round playoff series, moving on to the second round.
So we've been kind of discussing this all morning. I don't feel like I've actually found a satisfactory answer, but do you think that we're watching anything in the NBA that is leading to like a philosophical change of this is moving from one thing to another, or do you think we're kind of just watching some basketball series and people are trying to figure out how to advance?
In the moment, I would say the latter. I think after it's all said and done, you sort of pull back from it and try to reflect a little bit, maybe. But there's always a danger of assuming whatever has just worked is the thing that's going to work next.
Right.
And I think we've learned there are different ways to reach a goal. There are different kind of team constructions. There are different kind of styles. I did think last year it was sort of notable that Indiana, the two teams in the finals, Indiana, Oklahoma City, had sort of gotten there from some similar sort of styles in terms of using depth and using pace and sort of leveraging that over the course of, you know, a four playoff series, having the depth and the sort of the quality of play up and down instead of being teams that relied so much just on an individual talent. Even though one of those teams, the team that won, had the league MVP, it was still like it was their defense and depth that really drove their success. I'm a little wait and see. We'll see how it goes. I mean, I think one thing we can say for certain is that injuries help sort things out in the postseason, and that's been true. That will continue to be true. And I think a thing that people are coming around to really embrace, and whether the league is willing to make an actual change, they've been resistant to, I don't know. But I think people are starting to really agree that the combination of play style in terms of pace and length of the season is just a little too much for the wear and tear. And so either the play style needs to adjust or the games need to shrink or some combination of both. But I think this sort of war of attrition thing in the playoffs is very much still an issue.
Well, because that was the other thing that Cobb and I were talking about. It's like, well, what if the lesson is the NBA is now more resembling the NFL, where it's like, which team has the fewest amount of significant players getting hurt for this, like, right, the longest amount of time? Like, that is kind of defined it. And obviously injuries always impact every series, but it does feel like in the last decade it's bitten the NBA more than it has. And maybe that's the, hey, you can't always just have, like, basically, you know, three teams that have all the players, and you've spread out the talent and, like, all these other factors. But it's like, what if really just the lesson is, like, you just got to stay healthy? It's like, well, what lesson is that? It's like, is that luck? Is that how you select players? Like, I can see where that's kind of an unsatisfactory conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something the league, again, to really look at in terms of play style and seasonal length. I just think the accumulative wear and tear on players over the course of the season. And you just don't know who's going to get healthy at the right time, who's going to stay that way. I mean, part of the story with Philadelphia is that suddenly Embiid and Paul George, playing and playing well in the series. And I think everyone knew 2 years ago when they added Paul George to Embiid and then Tyrese Maxey, who had taken this leap to be an all-star level player, that from a talent standpoint, that is a core that could win big. When you have talk about a guard, a forward, a big, but there were just so many injury questions, particularly around George and Embiid, and so much questions of when do they fall off? And it certainly seemed like, well, that just didn't work. You know, like putting that trio together just didn't work. And now suddenly they're healthy and they come back from 3-1 to beat Boston. But how long is it going to last, you know?
Well, I mean, that was kind of the other question that we had, was just like, in general, do we give up on teams too soon? And it's like, okay, that always comes across as like, oh, it's a criticism of the Grizzlies. Like, no, can we set something aside? I think the Grizzlies pulled the plug at an appropriate time. I do also wonder, though, in the NBA, it feels like we do probably give up on things a little too soon.
Maybe. I mean, it's just also individual. I mean,
100%.
In some ways, the big contracts sort of buy time sometimes because you can't get off of guys. Like, if it would have been easy to flip Paul George for positive return, they probably would have flipped Paul George 3 months ago.
Yeah.
And then you don't get to the point where suddenly he's playing well in a playoff series. So there's some of that. I'm reluctant to generalize too much. I mean, we're one round through a four-round postseason, so we'll see where things go.
Well, the other thing that Kyle and I were discussing is we've kind of reached a weird moment in time where if you're Nikola Jokic and it's like, all right, if you're trying to back up, you're the I just care about winning attitude and team, you're better off not signing the extension that they're going to put in front of you. But at the same time, it's like, well, what incentive is there to stay? Like, it's this weird, we haven't quite figured out like how to balance, how to pay your best players, yet also give your team the best chance. Like, that seems to be a weird thing that people are balancing.
Obviously, there's a lot of indications that maybe the Giannis stuff will break up in Milwaukee. But some guys just are one-team guys. And, like, you know, Dirk Nowitzki is an all-time great player who won one title in Dallas. And he just stayed in Dallas. The good and bad, he just stayed in Dallas, and that was his career. It wouldn't surprise me if Jokic, he may bow out earlier. You know, I don't know if he'll be playing at 38, 39. He may end it earlier. It wouldn't surprise me if he just stuck with Denver, and wherever it goes, it goes. If they're good, they're good. If they're not, they're not. And I don't think that – I don't think deciding that that's what you value, and we'll see if he does, I don't think that should be seen as, you know, like you don't care about winning if you're not trying to get to a different team kind of thing. We'll see. I know it's disappointing to look at a guy who's won multiple MVPs and say, well, he's only got one title. But, like, there are lots of guys like that. And, you know, Moses Malone is a guy who won multiple MVPs in a row, got one title. You know, you have all-time greats like Dirk, who's won title, Garnett won title. You know, I don't see this that big of a deal, honestly.
No, I think you mentioned this last week. If anything, it kind of makes you reframe the guys that were lead guys on multiple title teams. It's like that that should frame them in a different category.
Yeah, and part of that is like who you've had to play with or whatever, but like, I mean, you know, your LeBrons and Steph Currys and, you know, your Magics and Birds and Jordans, that may be a slightly different level than your Dirks and Giannis and Jokic's and those guys. You can be an all-time great and not be LeBron James, Steph Curry, Michael Jordan, you know.
Okay, then wanted to discuss your first preview, taking a look at the guards. I think the first question I have for you is, how clear was it to you to have Braden Burries in your top tier versus that second tier?
Well, I don't – let me be clear. I don't have them in a top tier necessarily. What I did with this column is I separated guys in the group based on player type. I'm going to rank players later after the combine. So the first group I have are players who are multi-positional. Darren Peterson, Keaton Wagler, Braden Burries. I put them together because – I think they can play on ball and off ball, and you can do different lineups with them. And then the second group, I have purely guards like Acuff and Flemings and Phylon. I'm not necessarily saying I think Burries is better than the guys in that second group. I'm just saying he's a different player type.
Well, Chris, I'm curious on that topic. Like, the combine will be going on a week from now. Is there anything from a Grizzlies perspective, maybe within that group of guards who are sort of clustered there, that you'll be looking out for or that you hope to learn from the combine as the Grizzlies kind of near this draft? Wherever they fall in the lottery, we know they're going to be going after a guard at some point. Like, is there anything we can learn maybe from the combine that could clarify that picture?
I feel like the two most important things that come out of the combine are just the straight-up measurements and the interviews. And the interviews, I'm talking about teams interviewing players, not media. So I think it's important for the teams to talk to guys, like maybe someone like Darren Peterson especially. But we're not going to know about that. I do think wingspan is something that I think matters. It doesn't matter definitively. I mean, look at Desmond Bane. But when you're talking about some of these smaller guards, I'm interested in how they actually measure. Someone like Kingston Flemings I'm particularly interested in because he's listed 6'4". People say he has a plus wingspan, but I think his frame is so small that I think the height and the length really matters for him. You know, is Darius Acuff going to come in at 6'3", or is he going to be shorter than that? again, I don't think any of these things would be like cross off the list if you're 2 inches shorter or your wingspan's 2 inches smaller, but I do think it matters around the margins. And so for some of the smaller guards, you know, like Acuff and Flemings in particular, I'm interested in to see what the measurements are going to be on those guys.
Well, kind of along the same lines. Now, I know that that's not going to – this breakdown will probably not apply, but I was kind of thinking in the abstract. Would you rather have elite offensive lead guard and good enough defender or elite defender – good enough offensive player?
Well, I think if you're talking about the guys who you're going to put the ball in their hands, I think the offense matters more than the defense. And so, the two sides of the floor are not equal when you're talking about who's going to be your primary usage player. I think the concern would be, is the defense, if a player is a negative defense, defensively, is it so negative that it really puts a ceiling on you in the playoffs? You know, the weak link idea. Again, you point to someone like Jalen Brunson, whose defense has been a problem at the far reaches of the playoffs. But he's also a guy who gets you to the far reaches of the playoffs.
Right.
And I think that trade-off is ultimately worth it. So I think the defensive stuff matters. I think we are in an era of the NBA where teams are really – where it's hard to keep bad defenders on the floor. But I think when you're talking about trying to find a centerpiece of your backcourt going forward with the idea that you're trading John Morant, the primary concern has to be who's going to generate the most offense for your team. And so I think that has to be the trump card on that. I think the defense matters around the margins, but if you think one guy's going to be an all-star level offensive engine and another guy's not, it gets to the Burries question, right? Like, I like Burries a lot, but if I think someone like Acuff or Flemings is going to be a guy who's going to really drive team offense in a major way, I'm not going to care as much about Burry's defensive, you know, being a sports solid defender.
Amongst that group, you've been high on Keaton Wagler probably before the rest of the country maybe had really caught on. But I got to imagine part of that is the positional size. Like, you can minimize maybe some of the defensive issues with your lead guard if that lead guard happens to be 6'6". I mean, I'm curious, like, to what extent does his size and the potential to at least play passable defense sort of influence your high take and high view on Keaton Wagler?
Yeah, I would say it's secondary, but I do think it matters. I think the flexibility, there's two things. One, there's the flexibility. If you're playing a team that has a really dominant, you know, dynamic on ball guard, you can play Wagler with a smaller, you play with Scottie Pippen, who's a plus, you know, the backcourt defender. You can get by with that kind of backcourt. So you can play different kind of lineups with a bigger guard like that and get him into different kinds of matchups. There's more flexibility there. I think his length by itself, as he gets stronger, will probably make him a better defender overall than some of the other smaller guards anyway. But my main thing with Wagler is I just think there's a combination of shooting and feel and size that I think when those things add up, you look around the league and who are like some of the great perimeter players of the recent era, they're not necessarily guys who are dunking all the time. They're not above the rim players. It's Cade Cunningham. It's Luka Doncic. It's Tyrese Halliburton. It's all these different kind of guys who have other elite skills, whether it's size or it's shooting or it's skill for the game or it's a combination of those factors. When you combine that stuff together, you can be a great perimeter player in today's NBA without being the guy who jumps out of the gym and is, you know, getting to the rim play after play. And I just think that Wagler has some of those sort of elite qualities that those players have. He doesn't have the strength of a Cade or a Luka. You're talking about 6'6", you're talking about the way he shoots with ease off the dribble, deep NBA range threes, and then this sort of composure and the feel that he plays with. I just think there are really high-end outcomes for him if he gets stronger and sort of adds that man strength over the next few years.
Well, it's kind of interesting because we were talking about, you know, what are the types of offensive guys that present the most problems? And it's not really like Paolo, you know, all right, everybody just find the matchup, like get him the ball and let's go. Not that I'm not, this isn't a crap on Paolo segment. I promise. But if you think about it, it's like, the guys that seem to be the most valued offensively are A, guys that can shoot it themselves, but B, it's guys that can pass it to the open guy to get said wide open shot in general. And is that what you liked about him? Because I feel like you were in on Wagler before. I feel like, other than like just college basketball hipsters that saw how many points he scored, like, you were in on him in terms of a legitimate prospect before anyone else.
Yeah, and I might be wrong, by the way. I mean, we'll find out. Partly it's sort of an aesthetic bias. I just find him really interesting to watch, and I enjoy watching him play. And I've had to try to separate how interesting I think he is from how good I think he'll be. I think he has a chance to be really, really good, but I acknowledge there's risk there because he doesn't add the strength. But I think that the point you bring up is the idea of the combination of shooting and processing.
Yes.
Quick decision-making to go along with the shooting. And I do value that both in terms of what I think is effective and in terms of what I enjoy watching more than I value just the ISO scorer type. That's something where I'll write about this next, but I sort of struggle a little bit with AJ DeBonta because I think he is more the Paolo kind of player. He's the Carmelo Anthony kind of player, like an incredible scorer, but how much does his individual incredible scoring going to drive good team offense, right? In terms of being able to get off the ball and shoot, in terms of being able to process and pass and playmake. I do think he improved as a passer playmaker over the course of his college season at BYU, and I think that's promising. But I wonder about a player like that relative to just the processing ability combined with the shooting. You've seen a less athletic guy like Wagler or like a Cameron Boozer, who I think you could run a lot of offense through because of his combination of shooting and processing.
I don't really feel like Peterson has displayed a great processing yet either. Do you?
Yeah, but that whole season was such a mess.
Yeah.
I think with him,
no, that's fair.
He was just such his ability to get into and make those shots was so smooth. And I think, and I did go back and watch, some of the high school stuff because I'd never seen any of that. He does look different physically. He looks more toned. He looks more explosive. I don't see him as I see him as more of a two guard. I see him as more of that Ray Allen, maybe more explosive Ray Allen type than I do, the big guard who's going to dominate the ball and be, and so I don't necessarily see him as, some more athletic Cade Cunningham, Luka Doncic, give him the ball and let him be the heliocentric guy. I probably see him as more of just a pure scorer. But I think he can step right into, if he's healthy, I think he can step right in and be like a 25 point a game guy.
There's also something to be said, Cobb, I think you'd agree. He also has a pretty shot. And so it's like I'm willing to give more benefit of the doubt to people that have a pretty shot than I am for guys that, well, it's effective. But it's like, yeah, if the form's good, I'm willing to kind of set aside red flags more so.
Yeah, I would concur with that. He my man has a clip he can pull from anywhere. And he's the ultimate no, yes guy,
yeah,
because he makes more of those shots than just about anybody out there. But it's been fascinating to watch how it's flipped. Like, it was Peterson one all year. Then DeBonta makes the late surge. He's now regarded as one. And then there's what seems to be a consensus as Boozer three, Caleb Wilson four. But, Jeffrey, you presented the interesting hypothetical. And, Chris, I'd love to know your take on this. If the Grizzlies landed at four, right? We've just assumed they're going guard and then big or something like that in this draft. But if they landed at four, Caleb Wilson's there. Do you take Caleb Wilson over having your first pick of these lead guards? That would be a very interesting hypothetical, and I don't know. Where do you land on that?
No, that's an interesting question because a lot of people thought about, do you take Boozer, Wilson, like ahead of a Boozer or higher than that? But if you stipulate that top three, if you think about the 16th pick, and I don't think they should think about it this way, I think you're more likely to find a quality starting power forward of the future at 16 to pair with a lead guard you would take at six than the other way around. Like, you could take, an Acuff, a Fleming, a Wagler, whoever you like, whoever's available to you. And at 16, like maybe a Hannes Steinbach's there. Maybe a guy I really like, Merez Johnson, is there. You already have your front court sort of centerpiece of Zach Edey, you hope. And so you can find maybe a starting power forward with your second pick. I don't think you're going to find an offensive engine at 16, you know, to put in your backcourt. And so if you're trying to maximize the value of the two picks, it kind of makes more sense in this draft to secure, if you think the guard who's there for you is, you know, even at four, is going to be an all-star level point guard. It kind of makes more sense to secure that early. It's just a matter of why do you think that guy is that? You know, do you think, you know, Caleb Wilson and those guards are in the same tier? Or do you think Caleb Wilson is a full step above those guys in terms of talent? I think that's the question. If you stipulate they're the same level of prospect, I think it probably actually does make more sense to go for the guard.
Well, to wrap up, that's an interesting thought experiment. If you're the Grizzlies and you know that this is an important draft, do you think it's more important to maximize the picks you have or play the draft that unfolds?
I think with the first pick, they have to take whoever they think is the biggest talent, period. I you don't know, especially now if these lottery rules change, you may have literally no control over it.
Right.
You don't know when or if you're going to be picking that high again. Even if you're at 6 or 7.
Yes.
Like, you know, when the rules change, you can have the worst record in the league and not be picking in the top 6 or 7. Plus, the draft is not supposed to be as strong. So I think the imperative with this draft for the Grizzlies is to get a player –